Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When the Bush White House replaced the crew of generals and civilians who first ran the Pentagon for them and brought in men like Robert Gates, General David Petraeus, and CENTCOM Commander Admiral William Fox Fallon, there were sighs of relief in the U.S. military, in much of the country, and around the world. Here, at last, were what seemed direct, honest men, but also cautious and competent warriors. Well, this week, one of them, Admiral Fallon, the four-star head of Central Command, overseeing Iraq and Afghanistan and much more, resigned after one too many disagreements with his president. This hour, On Point, CENTCOM head Fox Fallon falls on his sword. We'll look at what it means and what comes next. We'll hear in this hour from Zbigniew Brzezinski, from retired Army Major General William Nash, and more. Joining me first from the Pentagon for an update is William McMichael. He is Pentagon correspondent for the Military Times newspapers, a part of the Gannett Group. William McMichael, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. You're welcome.
Please tell us about what happened here. We have heard over this last year a lot of unvarnished commentary from Admiral Fallon. He'd had plenty to say about what's gone on and going on in Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and elsewhere in his huge area of command. Then came, in the last few days, a big magazine piece, an Esquire magazine, where he had a lot to say and was presented as the last man standing between the United States and war with Iran. So fill us in from there, Bill. What happened?
Well, he probably said a little bit too much publicly. It's well known within the building here that Mr. Gates came on board with an interest in trying to reverse the policies of his predecessor and take in more input from his senior commanders, to listen to them, to solicit their advice and so forth. But that sort of advice, that sort of unvarnished advice, I should say, is something that is typically supposed to be presented in private and not in public. And even when you're put in a public position and asked to comment, as Admiral Fallon and other senior commanders are when they testify before Congress, you generally get a tempered response and something perhaps, if there's a disagreement, that doesn't spell it out in such stark terms.
Remind us just how big a responsibility Admiral Fallon has had, just how key Central Command is.
Well, it's gigantic. He oversaw the wars in Iraq and, to some extent, in Afghanistan, at least the supply effort, the force generation effort for those efforts. Central Command is gigantic. It's one of the nine unified commands that is in the Department of Defense, and it covers the entire Middle East and part of Central Asia, 25 nations. And as such, he oversees in excess of 200,000 troops currently. Now, he doesn't have any permanent forces, but they are under his control as they flow in and out of the theater.
Secretary of Defense Gates called him one of the best strategic thinkers in uniform today, but he's been outspoken on Al Jazeera last fall. He said the constant drumbeat of conflict, presumably, I guess they're referring to the sound out of the White House crowd, is not helpful and not useful. Talking about Iran, he said, I expect there will be no war. And that is what we ought to be working for, even though President Bush has said again and again all options on the table.
Yeah, and Secretary Gates has said the same thing, that there's no war plan. There's any talk of an imminent war with Iran is just ridiculous, as he put it the other day in a press conference. What Admiral Fallon said there, to a large extent, doesn't conflict with what has been said by other officials, but I think there's a cumulative effect here, and probably the Esquire piece put him in a bit of an untenable position, even though he certainly wasn't saying that he was the last man between the administration and war with Iran.
And in fact, he said at one point, look, if it comes to it, he said something like, their ants will crush them. But he also said that a superpower like the U.S. in that part of the world with five or six pots boiling over, our nation can't afford to be mesmerized by one problem. The suggestion there that the White House has been or is, in fact, mesmerized by Iran.
Well, that might be true. It probably is true. But it's one thing to say that, you know, nothing's imminent, and another thing to get caught in that position where your wider range of your views is so exposed in a magazine piece.
There was also conflict reportedly with General David Petraeus and some tension over Iraq policy with Admiral Fallon saying, well, if things are going so well in the surge, then let's start to pull down our troop numbers, which is not currently the plan.
Yeah, well, that's why that conflict with General Petraeus has been widely reported. I talked to him last year about that, and he told me, yeah, there's been some lively arguments, but he vehemently denied the two had a dysfunctional relationship. But that seems to go counter with a lot of other reporting that I've heard. The truth is probably somewhere in between. And it may be just a matter of in the eye of the beholder, what's right.
How rare is it for a four-star commander, head of Central Command, to just abruptly announce his resignation and head for the door?
Well, it's extraordinarily rare. And it comes at a particularly critical time because the top commander in Iraq, that is the subordinate to Admiral Fallon, General Petraeus, is about to come back to Washington and reprise his September appearance before the Hill and before President Bush and presenting an assessment of what's happening in Iraq and the way ahead, particularly with regard to prospective troop levels in the coming year.
And just at that moment, off goes Admiral William J. Fox Fallon, William McMichael with the Military Times newspapers at the Pentagon. Thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome, Tom.
I want to turn now to Zbigniew Brzezinski, former National Security Advisor to President Jimmy Carter. He's a trustee of the Center for Strategic and International Studies, author of Second Chance, Three Presidents, and The Crisis of American Superpower. Mr. Brzezinski, thanks very much for being with us today.
Good to be with you.
What do you make of the abrupt departure of Admiral Fallon, head of CENTCOM?
Well, I have mixed feelings about it, because to the extent that he has been cited accurately, and he's been cited quite a few times,
yes,
occasionally in a somewhat sensational fashion, I tend to agree with his views. On the other hand, I also am of the view that in the military, there should not be a tendency for senior generals or admirals to speak out publicly on policy issues in conflict with the presumed leanings of the administration. Obviously, the example of General MacArthur comes to mind.
Mm-hmm.
Many people passionately agreed with MacArthur, and yet the fact is there was, to put it mildly, ambiguity in the way he subordinates himself to the commander-in-chief.
In Korea with President Truman, but in this war in Iraq and in the surround, Zbigniew Brzezinski, there's been a lot of, we read, chatter among junior officers saying the top brass of the U.S. military has rolled over for ideologues in the White House.
But wait, I don't dispute that, and I agree with his views, but if he were expressing his views privately mm-hmm. to the Secretary of Defense, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and through them to the President, I think he would be doing better than letting it be conveyed to the public by direction or indirection through interviews or stories about conversations with him, such as the one by Barnett, which might be somewhat sensationalized, but which nonetheless really puts the issue on a very sharp edge. I happen to be strongly of the view that a war with Iran would be a disaster, both for the United States and for Iran. I suspect that others in the administration share that view. I think probably Gates is not an enthusiast for a war with Iran. But that kind of debate should be conducted within the administration. Now that the admiral's out, he can, of course, contribute very constructively to the public debate. And I assume he'll be called to testify. I assume at some point he'll give interviews and so forth.
Washington Post says today that his resignation is now not seen in the Capitol as a step toward an attack on Iran, that even those who may have wanted to keep that option open no longer see it as fully viable within the Bush administration because of all the obligations the U.S. military has already taken on.
I think that is absolutely the right judgment. Now, whether that is percolating within the administration, I am not sure, but I certainly hope so. I suspect that sensible people, like Gates, for example, are aware of the potentially devastating consequences for the United States in the region, in the world, and also economically, of some silly adventure directed at Iran, undertaken by us directly or by others with us winking.
Zbigniew Brzezinski, President Bush often says that, you know, it's his instinct, his way, is to follow the advice of his commanders. But here's one where they just kind of got in each other's faces and the commander's gone. So is it he follows their advice when it's what he wants, and when it's not, they're out?
Well, I'm not sure that's entirely true either. I'm not sure that the commanders were advocating the war with Iraq. They're willing to carry it out, and they felt fairly confident about its military dimensions, but they certainly weren't expressing a desire for a war with Iraq. It was the president who decided that. It was a war of choice, not of necessity. In this particular case, there may be some officers who would like a crack at Iran, but I do suspect, and here I agree with you, that the vast majority of the military think it would be an absolutely ridiculous undertaking at a time when we're so heavily overstretched in Iraq, in Afghanistan, potentially in Pakistan, not to mention the financial consequences.
Zbigniew Brzezinski, former National Security Advisor, author of Second Chance, with us today from Boca Raton, Florida. Mr. Brzezinski, thank you for joining us.
Well, it's very good to be with you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the abrupt resignation this week of four-star General Admiral William J. Fox Fallon. He is, and will just be for a few more days, the head of CENTCOM, the absolutely critical U.S. military command that stretches from Pakistan, Afghanistan, Central Asia, all the way across the Middle East to the Horn of Africa. He is the man who was putatively in charge of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. He's been outspoken, not always right on the same page of the hymn book with the Bush White House. Now he's gone after an article, The Man Between War and Peace, that came out in the recent issue of Esquire magazine by Tom Barnett. You heard Zbigniew Brzezinski's view of what's happened right there. I'm joined now in the studio by William Nash, retired Army Major General, now a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He led an armored brigade in Desert Storm, served in Bosnia and Kosovo as military and civilian commander of peacekeeping forces there. General Nash, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom. Good to be with you.
And we are joined from McLean, Virginia, by General Volney Warrior, retired four-star Army General. He once held the position that Admiral Fallon held until he resigned this week. He was Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Readiness Command, now known as CENTCOM. General Warner, thank you very much for being with us today.
Well, thanks for having me, Tom.
As a longtime military man who served essentially in this same post, do you think Admiral Fallon stepped over the line in his public criticism or departure from administration policy or leanings on the Middle East?
Let me talk about the process for a second.
Yes.
When you're a commander-in-chief and you receive strategic or operational guidance that based on your accumulated personal experience you can't execute, you have three options. You can explain your position up the chain of command, talk to the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the Secretary of Defense, if need be the President, and attempt to change the guidance, staying within the system. Or you could go to the so-called Hill and attempt to get congressional influence to change it. Or three, you can go to the press, stir up public sentiment sufficient to get the guidance changed.
Right.
My personal view is that option one is no doubt the preferred choice. Admiral Fallon's request for early retirement was a correct decision, and I applaud him for it.
Early retirement is a kind of a nice way of putting it. It's put as abrupt resignation in the Washington Post. You requested early retirement all the way back in 1981 because of a dispute over the best way to deploy forces in the Middle East.
That's correct. There's a big difference, though, between early retirement, where you also receive the benefits associated with your long service, and resignation, where you do not. And it's my understanding that what he did is he resigned or asked to be retired instead of resignation, but he, of course, would leave his job as the commander.
In the normal course of events, General Warner, how much longer would you have expected Admiral Fallon to serve as head of CENTCOM?
I would expect that it would be a two-year tour as such.
So halfway through, and he's out. You've read the Esquire piece.
I have.
It was provocatively put by Tom Barnett, who wrote it. On the other hand, the quotes in there from Admiral Fallon clearly have been seen as provocative. Do you think that the substance of his critique was worth the high profile of how he lobbed it?
Well, my own preference, I'm back to what Mr. Brzezinski said. It's a lot better to go ahead and lob that up through the chain of command rather than go to the press or the Hill to go ahead and reflect those sentiments. Your first attempt should always be to try and change the name of your what your boss has in mind, and to go outside that has some decided disadvantages. Number one, when you're in a war and you go public with that sort of information, it doesn't do much for the mindset of the mothers and fathers who, you know, entrusted the lives of their sons and daughters to you for the pursuit of a war. That's a risk. It doesn't do a lot of good either for the people who are fighting that war, who began to, in their own minds, say, oh, look, the big guys up above us can't seem to get their heads on right and decide what we're supposed to do. So in time of war, it's even more urgent to go up the chain of command and not go to the Hill and not go to the press to try and get guidance changed or to air what are contrary views, in my view.
General Warner, let me turn for a moment to retired Army Major General William Nash, who's with me in the studio. We're looking here at Admiral William Fallon's abrupt departure. I misquoted him slightly earlier in the hour, saying that one nation can't afford to be mesmerized. Our nation cannot afford to be mesmerized by one problem. He was referring there to Iraq, as quoted in the Esquire article. General Nash, what do you make of the William Fallon, I guess at this point, nearly a saga? It's gone on for most of his time at the top of CENTCOM. Was this a good appointment in the first place? Was he the right man for the job? Should we, as citizens, be interpreting his abrupt departure as a sign that we've got deep disagreement within the top ranks of our military and civilian leadership on how to proceed here?
Well, I think, Tom, you asked me about six questions,
yes.
So I'm going to answer the one I want.
Okay.
I think it was a great appointment. Admiral Fallon demonstrated when he was the commander of the Pacific Command of his unusually broad understanding of the political military dynamics of the Pacific area, particularly with respect to dealing with China. And he initiated a series of engagements with the Chinese military that over time was having great impact on our relations and, in fact, enabled cooperation on the military front to include, by the way, the war on terror that was to great benefit of the United States. And so I think it was a wise appointment to bring our what some would consider our very best political military leader of the armed forces to the Central Command, the key theater of operations for the nation's security.
But that may also have been the kernel of the problem here. He chose to engage with China when there many others had shown an instinct to confront, including Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. Now he comes into the Middle East, where confrontation has been the overarching theme of this administration. And again, he was talking engagement. It turned out to be in conflict with the vibe out of the White House, more than the vibe.
Well, I guess I would just say in reply that they certainly knew what they were hiring, because they were hiring a fellow who was a tough sailor and a very capable professional military man, but one who saw beyond the guns and airplanes of the military and saw political engagement as being key to overall strategy of U.S. national security. So they knew what they were buying when they moved him to the Pacific, to the central region. And I would just add that his point that you referenced earlier about being mesmerized by Iraq.
His complaint that the U.S., that the White House may be mesmerized.
Right, and trying to broaden the concerns. And again, this is one of the, I think, the great attributes of Admiral Fallon was to see the bigger picture and try to shape strategy in the entire region as opposed to operations in one particular area being Iraq.
Sounds to me that you're kind of in the Fallon camp then, that you would see us as too mesmerized, as not big enough in our view of what's going on. Do you agree with Admiral Fallon that we're kind of off of true north here in our policy in the Middle East?
In a word, yes.
I've only wondered, did they bring in the wrong guy if they wanted to continue on a path of confrontation?
Well, I'm on a different track. I think it's somewhat endemic to the Navy in a way. Army-Navy game is not just a game, it's a mindset. When a captain on the bridge of a carrier calls out 2 points to the starboard full speed ahead, everybody goes where he says they're to go. I think you get to be in a habit of that's the way it's supposed to work. For example, in an Army unit, when a division commander says, take the ridge line, you're going to have somebody say, which ridge line, why me, when do we get hot chow? So the demands of command in the Army and the Navy are somewhat different. And it doesn't surprise me at all that when he was given the broadness of his command, that he would expect to remain in that chain and the subordinates would come to him rather than, say, go direct to the president or to the Congress with what they thought should be their recommendations on how to pursue the war, be it Afghanistan or Iraq. So I can very well appreciate his concern and his desire to, you know, chain of command is a very important thing. Once you start to broach it, things start to come apart. And I can sympathize with his position.
But Admiral Fallon, with a reputation for not mincing words, he may have engaged with China. He may have had an inclination to engage with Iran, but he could peel a varnish off a wall, we're told, when he was fired up. General Warner, General Nash, please stand by for a moment. I want to welcome into our conversation from Arlington, Virginia, Ambassador James Dobbins, Director of the International Security and Defense Policy Center, served as Special Envoy for Somalia, Haiti, Bosnia, and Kosovo. Ambassador Dobbins, thanks very much for being with us today.
Pleasure. Thanks.
What's your sense of the implications of Admiral Fallon's departure for U.S. policy in Afghanistan, Iraq, potentially toward Iran?
Well, I'm not sure that one can at this point draw any firm conclusions. I don't think he was encouraged to leave because of the positions that he was supporting. I think he was encouraged to leave because he went outside channels in pushing those positions. So I don't think that they're necessarily going to replace him with somebody with different views, but they are going to replace him with somebody who will be discreet about expressing those views outside channels.
But does that mean that the White House is on the same page as Fallon? It seemed in his comments that he was pushing against, as he said, let's not be just mesmerized with Iraq. He seemed to be pushing to begin pulling troops out of Iraq if the surge was succeeding, whereas Secretary Gates has decided not to do that. He seemed to be pushing for more engagement with Iran when President Bush certainly hasn't been willing to talk that way. Did you see a substantive disagreement of significant proportions here?
I think on Iraq, I don't know that there's a substantive disagreement because I don't know that the administration has come to a final decision. There's clearly tugging and hauling between theaters, between Iraq and Afghanistan, between agencies, probably within the White House itself, as to whether or not how long one should pause in reducing troops from Iraq. And I don't think the president has made a decision there. And I don't think anybody felt that Fallon's position was an illegitimate one, even if it wasn't necessarily the one that the president in the end was going to choose, given that Petraeus appears to have a somewhat different emphasis. On Iran, the administration is and has been for the last 7 years badly divided, and Fallon represented one strain of opinion, which is that we'd know more about what the Iranians think and want if we talk to them. We might not be able to agree with them, but at least we'd have more information, and was therefore favoring engagement. There are others in the administration who favor this. They may be in a minority, and they haven't gone public. And I think it was his going public in this regard that was the problem.
Gentlemen, let me turn to our listeners for a moment. From Davenport, Iowa, Jean is calling. Hi, Jean. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I just have a comment. I think it was extremely brave what the general did in coming out against this war in Iran. I think that this administration has been extremely reckless in their use of the military. And while I certainly understand the importance of going through military channels to get things done, I think that bringing this into the public debate and kind of taking our minds maybe away from the issues of the Spitzer deal and, other maybe not quite so far-reaching current events, I think that needs to happen in this country. I mean, this thing with Iran has been brewing in the background for a long time. I'm extremely concerned that President Bush will initiate hostility toward them before he decides to leave office or has to leave office in 2009.
Jean, we've got it. You're glad for Admiral Fallon stepping up and speaking out. We appreciate your call. James Dobbins, there's one citizen saying, "This is. I'm glad for this. This gets us focused on what matters, and thank you to the commander for doing it. But you heard Volney Warner earlier saying, General Warner saying, might have been better keeping it in-house up through the chain of command.
Well, I think those of us who think an attack on Iran would be a mistake regret that Fallon has left and wish he'd kept his mouth shut so he could stay and continue to work against it.
William Nash, is there a point at which a commander looks out and says, well, I've made my case inside and it's just not having sufficient effect. I have to speak publicly.
Well, I'm not sure we can attribute to Admiral Fallon yet that he has spoken publicly about the disagreement. Two factors I would include in the discussion. First of all, in addition to his private statements, in addition to his public American statements, he is also the Central Command commander, is faced with meeting with the President Mubarak's, the General Musharraf's, and the like.
Which he has done a lot of in Egypt, in Pakistan.
And trying to keep together a semblance of a consensus with U.S. operations in the region. And there's great concern from Egypt to Pakistan and many other places in the area about a potential war with Iran and what that would mean to all the various countries. And his assurances to those leaders and to the citizens of those countries that the United States is not a rogue elephant and going to go to war at a drop of a hat is a wise and substantive act on his part for the benefit of the United States. Even if we are going to go to war, calming people is a better action at this time than the alternative. Lastly, I think you come to a point as a commander that when you come to the conclusion that you no longer have the confidence of your boss, and this, I think, is a factor that played into Admiral Fallon's decision, that there was such a disagreement, and not that he was going to go public with his disagreement, but that he realized there was a lack of confidence in his approaches, in his strategic approach, in the conduct of his duties, then I think it's a requirement then for him to retire. And his statement of retirement was not a slam against the policy of the United States. It was, in fact, that he thought he was doing a disservice and his presence was a distraction to U.S. interests.
He was conciliatory in his departing comments.
That's
he
right.
called the Esquire article a kind of poison
right.
pill, said it spun too much in the critical direction. Ambassador Dobbins, I know we just have you for another half minute. Do you expect David Petraeus, General Petraeus, to be promoted on up through the ranks to this CENTCOM position now? Or, I mean, his views seem more in line with the White House, or to stay right where he is in Iraq?
Well, I don't know we don't know what his views are on Iran. He clearly has a view that one needs to adequately resource Iraq. That's a function of his position there and not surprising. I think given his success in Iraq, and he is the first general we've sent that's had a modicum of success there, it would be foolish to withdraw him, even though the normal period of his command is coming to a conclusion. And if you were going to withdraw him, the only position you'd want to withdraw him to is one in which he continues to be responsible, which is to CENTCOM.
Ambassador Dobbins, with that, we come right to the wall of our breaker, and I know I have to let you go. Thank you very much for being with us.
Good.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the abrupt departure of Admiral William J. Fox Fallon from his post as head of Central U.S. Central Command, CENTCOM, great big military zone region from stretches from Pakistan and Afghanistan all the way to the Horn of Africa, right across the Middle East. The departure comes after an article in Esquire magazine written by Thomas Barnett, former professor at the Naval War College, said that Admiral Fallon was, quote, brazenly challenging the Bush administration's push to go to war with Iran, fighting what he called against what he saw as an ill-advised action. Admiral Fallon is out. He says the article went too far, was a poison pill in depicting his views, and yet there clearly was a conflict here. I'm joined in this hour by retired Army Major General William Nash, now a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, and from McLean, Virginia, by retired four-star Army General Volney Warner. He once held the position Admiral Fallon held until his resignation this week. He was Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Readiness Command, now known as CENTCOM. Let's take a call from Mark in Shelburne, Vermont. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Good show.
Thank you.
My comment is that I applaud Fallon's choice, and I think it's the correct thing because he went up the chain in the sense that we, the populace, are the president's boss, and we don't seem to be getting all of the information from the administration.
So was he right to complain out loud or right to leave or both?
I think he's correct to complain because we seem to be only getting a unified opinion from the administration that doesn't give us very much information. And I think him leaving is a poor choice, but more so I think it's a poor choice on the place of the president.
But shouldn't the president have the last word? I mean, he does. Fallon's gone, but the president's the commander-in-chief.
He is, but knowing that there's not such a unified opinion in CENTCOM is reassuring to me. I don't want to think that it's just a uniform block of opinion and it will roll forward however it sees fit. Having multiple opinions and choice, especially at the highest levels, is always a benefit.
Mark, thanks very much for your call. General Warner, share your insight here with us. Time magazine, writing up what's happened here, says, you know, there are times when a military man achieves immortality by jumping on a grenade to take the explosion. They said, in this case, Admiral Fallon threw the grenade with his comments in the Esquire piece, and perhaps over time, and also fell on it to take the explosion with his departure. What is the appropriate dynamic when there's real dissent, real disagreement? How does that unfold within the military? How should American citizens be thinking about the glimpses they're seeing of what's going on inside the Pentagon?
Okay, let me try that with a little different tack, if I might.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, the admiral should not have been throwing the grenade. And he's in a situation that he need not have been placed. Actually, to rely totally on the uniformed military to take political actions and play the roles that are otherwise played better by ambassadors is not a good policy. And I think it's unfortunate that we have now what basically is a political war. And obviously there are any number of situations where the, I'd say, state is a better player in this regard. And if we were to take, you mentioned Admiral Fallon's large geographical area that includes at least three, probably four countries.
Mm-hmm.
If we would
continents,
take,
practically. Mm-hmm.
Pardon?
Continents, practically.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm.
The House Hask Committee is beginning to get a handle on this. And if you go back to 1947 and look at how to better revise the roles and missions in the United States government, how to bring the soft power aspects of government into play, such as aid, commerce, CIA, and otherwise, and make the role of their expertise as it used to be underneath the ambassador and the country team in the same regions that Fallon's asked to function, and make the geography the same as his, so you have a political and a military interface that's making the response to Pakistan and elsewhere, rather than putting either a sailor or an army guy out front, you're likely to get a far better result. And we haven't seen fit to do this, and in my view, there are a lot of situations in the world that we cannot resolve militarily. Vietnam was one, Iraq is another, and we seem to be slow to come up on the larger solution.
General Nash, this is an issue that's been raised, that the power of a CENTCOM commander, just to take one, has grown so large, so multifaceted, to encompass all the military power of the U.S. in that region, but also what is clearly a diplomatic role when he's sitting down with Mubarak, with Musharraf, I think it's Admiral Fallon himself who remarked it's grown into sort of the stature of a Roman proconsul responsible for America's entire panoply of interests in this region. Is it just too much? Has State Department been too diminished, the diplomatic side? Would it have the resources to step up to this challenge if handed the role?
Well, I think the title of proconsul was something that was coined by Dana Priest in her book, The Mission, a couple of years ago.
At the Washington Post.
Dana Priest from the Washington Post, as she took a look at the combatant commanders around the globe, to include the CENTCOM commander of the day. I think General Warner's comments are exactly correct about the fact that this needs to be an all-government effort as we approach issues of national security.
Not just the Pentagon.
Not just the Pentagon, but understand the combatant commanders have grown to this role not because they particularly sought it, but because of the absence of expertise and engagement by other elements of the government, to include the National Security Council leadership that comes from the White House.
But why have the others become relative midgets, if that's the case, in terms of expertise and resources compared to this giant Pentagon?
Well, my personal view on that is that there has been a lack of development, professional development, in those other agencies, particularly the State Department. The State Department should be in charge. But they have not engaged in this fashion. They continue to operate in a fashion far more similar to what they did in the Cold War, where there was a direct confrontation between the United States and the Soviet Union with small démarches with other parts of the world.
But isn't this about resources, too? We've got here trillions going to the military of pittance by comparison goes to the State Department and our diplomatic corps.
I think you're right, and I think the concern here is not only with the Department of State and the Department of Defense and the other government agencies, but in the executive branch as a whole and in the legislative branch of our government, because Congress is still organized in such a manner that we don't bring together all forms of national power. For example, the House Armed Services Committees of both houses of Congress and the Foreign Relations Committees of both houses operate on different agendas with different authorization and appropriations means, whereas there's not a National Security Committee to address the full panoply of requirements to pursue our security interests.
General Warner, when such a huge spectrum of responsibility goes to a military officer, a four-star general, what problems does that create for him?
Well, I think you've already defined it. Your span of control becomes too great. Obviously, the military component of your activities are what you have to focus on to the most for the most part. But to add on also to what Bill just said, I think it's important to realize that in many parts of the world, especially in fighting a political war, that dollars are more important than bullets. And the Foreign Aid and Military Assistance Program, if it's administered under the ambassador and the country team and has a sufficient number of aid folks present, that you can actually restructure Foreign Aid and Military Assistance as a form of leverage, so that instead of just surrendering custody on the hook at the shoreline of $32 billion worth of equipment or gear, you can demand performance on the other end all the way from the national government down to the provincial level. We don't know how to wage political war, and we tend to do that which we do best. And, you know, the military is somewhat like a lawnmower. If you put it down, it's going to mow whatever's in its way, whether it particularly is the problem or not. And we've got to completely rethink this. And I believe the HASC is just about to come up on that issue. It's going to take a while, but we have to get the soft power elements of government back in business. We have to get the aid program reconstructed. Almost any element of government should be involved in a political war. It's not strictly a military component. Kinetics are not going to win it, and dollars are better than bullets.
General Nash, you hear the guy pushing that military lawnmower said this isn't enough, and he's out.
Well, I understand. But if I could just modify General Warner's expression just a little bit, we need to learn how to wage political and economic peace as opposed to military war. And
which seemed to be Admiral Fallon's message in many ways, though he's ready to bring the hammer down if required.
Well, that's right. And he talks about speak softly and carry the big stick. I think a better phrase would be to speak reasonably and be prepared to use the stick if necessary.
Let's go to Matt calling from Boston. Hi, Matt. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom. Let me begin just by congratulating. I think you've got a fantastic posting having Mr. Dobbins and Brzezinski, and in particular having Generals Nash and Warner on. And having been in the intelligence community myself, I can say that Mr. General Nash and Warner are household names in their respective services, and their opinions have tremendous weight.
Our good fortune to have them, Matt. What do you think about the issue here?
I think the issue from my background in intelligence, having been posted overseas for many years, is kind of a locker room talk among my community, which Nash and Warner have some opinions on, I'm sure, is the first comment I'd like to make, and maybe this is my own foul and like violation of trust, is there has been tremendous amount of doubt by men of high intelligence and high patriotism about the way in which our policies in the Middle East and overseas are being handled. And there is an interesting twist here. When you have really bright men, even men like Mr. Phelan, who are put to this point where they're in this dilemma, and I think what it raises the bigger question is, why we're in this dilemma at all? I mean, I totally understand Mr. Brzezinski's point, and as a military man, the point of insubordination. I think of, President Grant, two-time president, Civil War hero, in the war in Mexico, didn't agree with the war in Mexico, but kept his mouth shut and won many battles despite his disagreement with the policies. As a military man, as a patriot, I totally understand that need to understand the chain of command. The twist is now, and this is unlike MacArthur, this is even unlike Eisenhower in the sense that he warned about men trained in war, men trained in battle, men who might seem to be, looking for war. When men otherwise trained in that perspective are suddenly asking themselves, we might be going too far, we might be overstretched, we might be doubting the policies. The larger question we should be asking is why men in the military, men in intelligence, are losing faith in the policies of their commander-in-chief, and whether that should be public information, it's very, very scary for us to cross that line. It's even scary for me to make this call. But when great men and great minds start to doubt the policies of the Oval Office, that might be something that we should be more concerned about than just the specific nature of this article, which I myself haven't read.
Matt, you raise good points, and you put them well. We appreciate your experience being brought to bear. General Nash, what do you say to that?
Well, thanks for the kind words there, Matt, and your insights. I would just say that, Dr. Brzezinski started this off today with the view that he had mixed feelings, and I have very mixed feelings as well. The substance of Admiral Fallon's position with respect to Iraq, Iran, and the Mideast are ones that I'm very comfortable with and in large part agree with. But this may be a case of truth as no defense, because the responsibilities of a military commander in serving the nation and serving the commander-in-chief and in serving the Constitution does require a degree of loyalty to the same that goes beyond the normal measurements. And you have to faithfully execute that. And if you find yourself in a position, you do have to retire. You're not going to retire without notice when you're in a senior position. But I would point out that whereas Harry Truman fired MacArthur,
yes,
because of the disagreements, in today's world we work it so the officer concerned decides to retire. And that may be as much a measurement of his integrity as it is to the capacities of the leaders.
A little saving of face, nevertheless, he's gone. Let me get one more call from Bill in Hull, Massachusetts. Bill, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
Very brief comment. I certainly understand all the complicating factors involved in Admiral Fallon having gone public in Esquire magazine, but the thing that strikes me, and I'm probably repeating a little bit of what your previous caller just discussed, is this conversation seems to be focused more on process and procedure rather than substance. Here's a guy who has a 40-year career, a very tough Navy admiral,
yep,
very seasoned, a great deal of experience. He comes with a slightly adverse view to that of the administration and immediately is put in a position where he has to retire. And it strikes me as, once again, you have the voice of experience, guys in the field who know what's going on, who know what this really is going to involve, being put in a position where they're the ones who have to leave, and the commander-in-chief, who seems to me to have made nothing but a series of blunders all the way along the line, stays in office. Now, we'll have a chance to change all that, obviously, in the fall, but it just strikes me that, once again, someone with a valid point is put in the position of his point not being discussed as a substantive argument. It's more the process by which he did it.
Yep.
And for that reason, his opinion isn't heard, and he's forced to step aside.
Important process, but maybe more important substance here. General Warner, I wish you'd respond to each of our last two callers here. Matt saying, you know, he's out of the intelligence community. He's seen a lot of people, what he sees as people of real intelligence and integrity, with tremendous doubt about the policy that policies we've been following, a loss of faith. Do you see Admiral Fallon having been operating in a period, in a position where there was a more general loss of faith in overall U.S. policy?
I'm not sure that he was operating because of a lack of faith or because he thought that his solutions and his job and what he should be doing was somewhat different than the guidance that he receives. I happen to agree with that, but I again believe that your challenge is then to change the minds of those who gave it to you and do your best to try and bring that about.
You know, for citizens on the outside looking in, though, you can see it'd be a little unnerving when an officer with that much experience is out the door in a period when fundamental policies seem so much in question.
Yeah, I can understand also, but I think that's why we have elections also. And, you know, if you disagree totally with the policy, and I was told this by none less than General Taylor, that if you want to go political while you're still in the military, then hang up your uniform, rent a hall, and run for public office.
Well, there's a lot of running for public office going on right now. We're very grateful for the perspective that you bring to us. General Volney Warner, retired four-star Army general, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And William Nash, retired Army Major General, now a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Bill, we really appreciate your perspective today. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Tom, and thanks for being with General Warner, too. Great to hear him again.
Listeners, thank you for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.